Hello, and welcome to Clearer Thinking with Spencer Greenberg, the podcast about ideas that matter. I'm Josh Castle, the producer of the podcast, and I'm so glad you've joined us today. In this episode, Spencer speaks with Sarah Ness about the relating languages, communication patterns and styles, and emotional awareness and authenticity.
Sarah, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Spencer. I'm so glad to talk to you again.
So I first wanted to ask you about this idea that you've been developing, the relating languages. What are the relating languages and how can we use them?
Yeah. So I guess I want to say something first about why I thought that they were useful to come up with. So I teach this practice, authentic relating, and I've been really interested for a long time in how people communicate, starting from like co-living and then into just like ad hoc communities. And I got really into my practices, but then realized that like, for as good as these communication practices were, when people tried to do them with folks they really didn't get along with or had history with, like their parents or people they were on opposite sides of a political divide from, it just seemed like it broke down.
So it needed more like buy-in on both sides or a warmer relationship? What was missing there?
I couldn't figure it out for a long time, but it was almost like both people had to be willing to have the same conversation for the conversation to happen. And also the people that had learned really, quote, good communication thought that everybody should do it. Like there was this strong bias of, okay, now that we've learned these really good communication skills, we just need to teach them to the rest of the world and then everyone will get along.
Right. But the reality is most people aren't going to have those skills, right?
I just looked at history and I was like, wait a second, like that has never happened. We've never come up with an amazing idea and then just gotten everyone to adopt it and solved all our problems. So
maybe toothbrushing is the closest.
Ooh, yeah, good one. But even then you've got all the arguments about fluoride. I don't know. So I started questioning, like, if I'm not anticipating that people are going to change, is there something that would describe more of how we relate with each other and why we get into some of the conflicts that we do? And I realized that there were, as far as I could tell, like a lot of good systems out there for testing personality, but very few that described interaction styles. And obviously this wasn't just like, I woke up one day and went, aha, here's an idea. It was like a lot of interacting with people and going, why can't I talk with them? And then paying more attention to their communication and realizing that people kind of bias towards different forms of communication, right? Like some, you'll notice that some people tend to ask a lot of questions, right? And some people tend to tell a lot of stories and other people always want to talk about certain topics or it comes up in moments that they want to talk about topics. Some people tend to be a little on the outside observing. Some people crack a lot of jokes. So all of these I started thinking of as different languages. If like, you know, you speak English and then you walk into a space where everyone else is speaking Spanish, you're going to feel really on the outside, right?
Mm.
For example, I lived in Italy for a while and I had this experience once of being on a train and I overheard these people and it sounded like they were speaking Italian, but it was like a little bit off. I couldn't understand anything in it and I couldn't figure out why I didn't understand what language it was. And so finally I went up to them and they were speaking, I think it was Bulgarian. It was a language that was really similar to Italian, but just far enough off that I couldn't understand what they were saying. And I think that there's a way that we get that a lot in social situations where even though we're speaking the same national language, we're communicating in really different ways. And it's not just about the intention behind what we're communicating, but it's like that's part of it. But it's also just what we consider polite and what we consider normal. So if you're raised in a culture where it's really polite to ask people questions when you first meet them, and you meet someone that's from a culture where what's really polite is to tell people stories or introduce conversation topics, you're going to feel like the other person is really rude and doesn't want to get to know you. So that was kind of the theory that I worked off of. And as I discussed this with people and tested it, especially one of the things that was happening was I joined a new community. I was from this, you know, authentic relating, conscious communication, let's really feel each other, let's be very curious, let's hold lots of space, you know, all these kind of jargon words of basically how do we be the most kind and open to each other and really listen. And I was entering this community of artists and performers, folks that were really familiar with the nightlife, folks that had really interesting backstories. And I just continuously felt missed and hurt and like nobody there wanted to know me. And they had this little clique that I was on the outside of. And after a while, I started questioning, like, why do I feel like that? And I noticed that they just talked really differently than me. And just everything that I assumed was politeness and interest and curiosity, they didn't show any of that because that wasn't what the culture was about. Like, it was implicit in them that they wanted to know, but they didn't like go about it the way I was used to. And I spent a whole year just feeling offended and shut out to the point where I was actually considering just telling my partner, like, I'm sorry, like, this is a breaking point for me. Like, I cannot be around your community anymore.
Were you able to find a way to integrate?
Yeah, it was actually when I started coming up with this communication typology and I started listening from that point of view, like started going, well, if I assume that they do actually want to get to know me and that something about the way they're talking is telling me the opposite, what is going on here? Like, how do I create a theory about this and test it? So I started just trying to integrate, to watch the way people were interacting with each other and do more of that. So for instance, I would like start telling more stories about things that had happened to me and then they would interrupt, which to me historically means somebody doesn't want to hear what you're talking about if they interrupt you. But I kind of changed my perspective and I was like, well, what if I'm in a storytelling culture where the point isn't so much to like listen to the whole of each other's stories, but it's actually to like keep the conversation going and like get to know each other through this back and forth. What if it's something between like storytelling and like bringing up conversational topics? So I started just trying to do more of that and like take on this idea that interrupting wasn't automatically meant as an offense and almost like develop a little bit of a thicker skin where instead of having all my attention out towards the other person, I still had some in towards myself. And all of a sudden, like my relationship with them changed. It wasn't that anything they were doing changed, but my perception of what was going on and how much I was taking things personally kind of loosened. And then I found that when I was more comfortable interacting, parts of me that hadn't been comfortable before started coming out. Like, I really like cracking stupid jokes, but when I didn't feel comfortable around them, I didn't feel comfortable cracking jokes because I was worried that like I would get judged by a community I wasn't already part of. All of this kind of ended up going into the model where after I've kind of also like, I wrote this up, I sent it out to about 60 beta testers and they tried it out for a month and reported back in like a couple of different Western cultures.
Let's go through the elements of it. Yeah, I'd love for you to break it down.
Okay, so for one thing, this is a little different from a typology system where you basically get typed and you're like, you're an Enneagram 7. And that's kind of what you're always going to be, although you can be more or less skillful in the way you do it. And you have types and subtypes. This is more like, as far as I've been able to tell, we err towards certain types, usually one, sometimes two, when we feel in situations of stress and unsafety. And we err towards other types when we feel safe. So as an example, when I feel safe, I really like cracking jokes. I'm what I call a clown. But when I feel unsafe, like that capacity really goes away. And I go more towards this kind of observing, like I'm just going to wait and see if I understand what the social norms are. And we also have the capacity to use any of these languages anytime. So more than anything, I'm hoping this will be a developmental system where we see what languages we're not skillful in with different people in different situations and can try on and learn new ones. So as you're listening to this, like think about not so much which of these am I as like which of these do I use in different situations, which bug me when other people do them, which do I want to develop more competency in, and especially which do I use when I feel safe and when I feel stressed.
So would it be fair to say, essentially, what you're doing is categorizing the strategies people use to relate to others. And then additionally, you're observing that the strategies people use tend to change when they feel comfortable versus uncomfortable. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little bit like where the center of gravity individuals have is. It's not like we all adapt the best language for any given situation or we're chaotic in our languages. People do have certain languages that they've learned work better for them. Usually when you're young, what you see or what makes your parents and the people around you respond best are the primary languages you learn, but then you develop more over time. So it's something between like a category of universal interaction styles and a bit like a personality assessment of what do you err towards and who do you gather around you?
Right. Because if you categorize different strategies, then you can say, well, some people are going to use some strategies much more than others. And then you can use a typology and say, okay, they're this type of relator. So what are the sort of top level styles of communication?
Yeah. So there are six relating languages, and each of them has two, what I call dialects. There's a spectrum between the two dialects of each language that is based on how much of your attention is based inside yourself versus out towards the other person. So the top level languages are questioning, storytelling, joking, doing, conversing, and observing. And this is like what you tend to lead with in conversation. It's not necessarily what you tend to do all the time, or you maybe don't string one question after another for the entire conversation, but it's what you kind of orient towards. So under questioning, to use an example, the spectrum is between the more internally focused scientist and the more externally focused space holder. So in both of them, you're going to see them asking questions, but the scientist, their questions are going to be a little more almost like what we're doing now, right? It's like questions to like understand the world. Scientists might have more of a model on how things work. They might be very curious, but it's like a little, almost like more like leaning forward curiosity. Like, how does this function? How does this person work? How does the world work? Sometimes the questions are even a little more rapid fire. Oftentimes scientists have a motivation of safety. Like they want to understand the world so that they know how to orient towards it and know what to expect from it. And then on the other side of the spectrum, which is externally oriented, you have the space holders. And when space holders are asking questions, it's almost like they're like leaning back or sitting still with their arms open. Like their questions are about really wanting to hold space for the other person and be curious and like wait for the person to emerge. It's not so much based out of what information do I need to understand this person, but more like, who is this person and who are they to themselves? And there's kind of a different tone towards it. Like I always think of space holders kind of as mothers, but there are lots of men and people of any gender that embody these qualities. And of course, there's kind of not so much a goal of let me be one or the other of this. It's more like most people lie on a spectrum between them. Like sometimes your questions are based out of a desire to really understand, and sometimes they're based out of a desire to just like hold and be with. Being entirely on the ends of either spectrum in any of these types can be difficult, because if you only have attention towards yourself, you lose awareness of what's happening with other people. You can seem insensitive or unempathetic or self-centered, whatever it is. But if you're entirely on the other side and all your attention is out towards other people, you lose awareness of what your boundaries are and your desires. And space holders especially often end up getting taken advantage of, because people want their attention and they have whole conversations where like nobody asks them a question in return.
Right. So I'm just going to kind of break this down the way I understand it. I guess the way I look at it is, asking people questions is one way we relate to them, right? Like if you just got thrust into a new situation, you might start asking the person that you're interacting with questions. Then if we think about why might you ask someone questions, like what are sort of the motivations? It's like, well, one motivation is you want to understand things, and that's kind of the scientist. Another motivation is you kind of want to use the questions as a way to kind of open space for the other person to talk about what they want or what they're interested in, or for them to get value out of it. And that's kind of the space holder. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's a great recap.
Okay, great. So should we go on the next one?
Yeah. So the next one is the storyteller. And these are in no particular order, by the way. They're just in the order that I kind of thought them up in. So the storyteller, they go between the chronicler and the bard. Chroniclers, honestly, are one of the types that get the worst rap, but they're one of the best ways to explain relating languages, because they're the people who, if you meet them at a party and you ask them how they're doing, they'll just kind of go on a monologue. Like sometimes they don't even need to be asked a question. They don't have much awareness of whether people outside them are tracking what they're saying or are interested. They really want to like get the facts out there and have the story complete. They can actually even get upset if they're interrupted, because it really does feel like rudeness and it kind of disrupts the flow of where they're at in the story.
I've definitely met that person at the party before.
Yeah, everybody's met at least one of them. I have some that are really close to me and I'm like, you're really well-intentioned. And once you get the story out, you do have some spaciousness, but you just don't seem to notice if I'm losing attention. It can be really frustrating. And it's one reason why understanding like why they do that and that that's a conversational style can be useful, because then you can have some ways to orient around it. on the other side is the bard. And bards, when they tell stories, they're like, I call them the bard because you can imagine them sitting by a fire in some kind of old forgotten land and kind of telling the stories about the gods and the feats of great heroes. They are very expressive. They're all about communicating the story to their audience. They're responsive to audience cues. So whereas if you interrupt a chronicler, the chronicler might get offended. If you interrupt a bard, it just becomes part of the story. They tend to be like animated in expression, or at least have the ability to really like get a vision across of what they're talking about. They can also take up a lot of the space in the conversation sometimes because they are so interesting.
Great. Anything else on storytellers? Should we go to the next one?
So yeah, the next type is the joker. And I honestly kind of like this type one of the best because it was one of the most kind of biggest epiphanies of creating these languages for me was realizing that I have a lot of the joker type and I always kind of looked implicitly for people that could meet that in me, but never knew that was actually what I was looking for. And always felt kind of like, why don't people around me want to play with me? And felt kind of offended. And when I realized I had this type, I was like, oh, of course, this is my safety type. And I want other people to speak it with me so that I can be in that mode of just real enjoyment. So I've started looking for those people more since developing this. But the joker goes between the cynic and the clown. Cynics, and mind you, just as like a little bit of a kind of superscript on all this, this is still in development, and I'm aware that I'm trying to work with a psychometrics researcher to develop assessments on this and make sure it has internal validity. So if I say any of this and you're listening and you're like, that's not quite how I work, like, do I fit any of these? Just be aware that like you may be realizing a flaw in the model or a place that it needs to be improved. But from what I've seen, the more internally focused joker, they often stand a little bit out on the outside of groups. They tend to see the big picture of what's happening. Their comments aren't always jokes, but they're usually pretty insightful. And oftentimes they can be sharp-edged, like they can occur as joking or sarcastic. A lot of comedians can be cynics or the other side clowns, but the ones that are kind of most almost like skewering political thought or social thought, cynics, they just tend to have a pretty clear view on the world, and that can often make them feel, I don't want to say depressed, but like it can be hard to have that wider view and not just want to state the cosmic joke all the time or lampoon what you see happening. People can feel really hurt by them. People in my field have often felt, I think, really hurt by them because they require a lot of safety for you to get close. They use jokes oftentimes as a way to keep people a little bit away from them. And so you have to kind of be able to play with them to earn some of their trust or make really clear requests of what you want or be around them for a while before you get more let in. But they're brilliant. They're some of my best friends. On the other side, you have the clown, which is what I identify as a lot of the time. Clown, their jokes are oftentimes like pretty improvisational from the moment. Sometimes they're the folks that just do dad jokes. They're all about like what their audience reaction is, but they're often the people that will laugh loudest at their own jokes than anybody else. Their jokes aren't necessarily funny all the time, but they're less kind of considered than the cynic's jokes are, and they tend to be more towards the center of a group than the cynic, which is often a little bit on the outside. Fourth is the doer. And this one's interesting because the doer, like the observer, can be a little bit hard to see in social situations, but I include it because for a lot of people, this is actually their most comfortable relating language and one reason why some people don't feel comfortable in social situations. The doer goes between the maker and the helper. Makers more internally focused. Both these sides, like, they oftentimes prefer to have like something to chew on with their brain and or their hands. So they could be doing physical things, or a maker could be, you know, someone that's coming up with theories. Like, it can also be more mental. But they're really like interested in oftentimes their particular field or fields of interest. If they get bored in a conversation, they'll just kind of start constructing those in their head and like thinking about the topic. Like, they can kind of check out or even wander away. Makers oftentimes pretty comfortable spending some time alone, and they interact with other people. As far as I've seen, one of the main things that they'll interact with is like when they have projects that include a lot of people, but then like you'll see them, like burners, for instance, very often have a lot of maker in them where their talk is about the topic. So if you're in conversation, you catch that topic they're really interested in, they become a fount of information and really excited. But if you don't catch to that, they'll oftentimes seem like a little bit distant or disengaged. On the other side, helpers, they are much more focused externally on like, what can I do that's going to like assist others, or what can I do in response to what's happening around me? Like, they're more comfortable if they're at a party helping make dinner or doing the dishes than they are just having conversation. Like, you could have a great conversation with them while they're doing that, but they really like having something to do. And even in conversation, if you are talking about a thing, they might be the one that's like, oh, I've got like an idea of a person that could help with this, or like they can orient towards what can I do.
Got it.
Yeah. Both those types can show up a little bit as high anxiety if their basic needs aren't being met.
Okay. And the fifth language?
Yeah. So two more. Fifth language is the conversationalist. I'm still figuring out, I think this one is different than the storyteller, but they might be similar enough to combine parts of them. But the conversationalist, their conversations are more topical and less focused on completeness than the storyteller. So they go between the internally focused teacher and the more externally focused turn taker. Teachers, they want to get their ideas across pretty much. Like, they are the most likely to give advice. If they hear something from someone, they're like, oh yeah, you know, here's the experience I have in this, or yeah, let me tell you about whatever. They want to be helpful. They want to show that they know what's going on. They're not always super great at checking if the other person wants to hear it. So that's like a major growth path with them. And then on the other side, you have the turn taker. The turn taker really just wants to keep conversation going. They oftentimes are kind of lambasted for being the ones that do a lot of small talk, because for them, it's not even always so important what the content of the conversation is, as long as everyone's engaged in it. So they'll bring up topics, they might ask questions, but they don't always follow with more questions. They're more likely to like respond with like a similar idea or anecdote or whatever, but it's like very much a back and forth. And then the last type is the observer, which at first it was really funny. This was the only one that at first I didn't have in my model at all, until the beta testers started coming back with like, hey, I think there's this type, and they all described it a little bit differently. And then when I looked at it, I was like, oh, there's an observer type that, because I'm pretty talkative, I just don't notice. And that was really telling for like, oh, I wonder how many observers have that experience of just going unnoticed. A little harder to categorize, because what you see on the outside, unlike the other types, is pretty similar with the observer, because you'll just see them being silent. But I think what's happening on the inside is pretty different. And they go between the guardian and the witness. Guardians, they are observing and they have their attention more internal because they don't quite feel safe to speak. Like, they want to figure out what the social rules are before they jump in and engage. Oftentimes, the guardians I've talked to have come from somewhat unsafe family environments where they had to like try to find a way to predict their parents' behavior, but it was like difficult to predict or changeable. So they learned to like not talk until they really got what was going on. Can be like a little bit towards frozen, but also sometimes like wanting to offer value before speaking up. The witnesses are more kind of out towards the space observing, because like they genuinely don't feel a need to say something until they have something that feels really pertinent to say. They can be tracking the conversation. If you ask them, they can have really great insights about what's going on, but they might not speak just because they don't really feel a need to. I know one friend who, just as like an example of a growth path, who definitely like grew up being a guardian, and then through a lot of like meditation and authentic relating and like really paying attention to their internal state and learning to calm it, now like has moved much more towards a witness and is just this immensely kind of calming and present person to be around, and very insightful, even though he oftentimes won't volunteer things unless you ask.
So I really like this framework, but I want to go meta for a second. I want to talk about, what does it really mean? Like, what is it really doing? And try to preempt some things that I think listeners kind of might have in their head. Because I think that one thing that can happen with a framework like this is people can say, well, you know, what's the evidence here? Like, aren't you just making this up, right? So I think there's sort of like different forms of validity for a framework like this. And the most basic form of validity is that you could just be claiming to be categorizing the things that there are, right? So if you have this idea of a MECE framework, which stands for mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive. And so you can take any kind of thing, whether it's animals or relating styles or love languages or whatever, and you can just empirically look at the world, look at all the different kinds there are, try to notice all the ones that exist, and then you can try to build a MECE framework where you just kind of cut it into groups that are mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive, to try to cover everything, right? So that's one thing that this could be trying to do. It's just saying, hey, I've noticed that there are these different patterns in the way people relate to each other. Let me just cut them into these groups, and then I'm going to group them. And there's a sense in which it's empirical. It's trying to catalog what's actually there, but it's not sort of making sort of additional like predictive claims. It's just saying these are the different kind of patterns that we observe. And so at that level, it seems to me that, you know, you could ask, okay, first of all, are they mutually exclusive? Well, I don't think you're really claiming that, you know, you can't be multiple of them. I think you could just say that, well, typically people will have one or two that they tend to do more than others, which I think is fair enough. Certainly, it seems like all of these types are, you know, real patterns of behavior people actually have. And then someone could say, well, are they collectively exhaustive? Like, are you claiming there are no other ways of relating? And I think my guess is you would not claim that. You would not say that this is fully exhaustive of all different ways. Is that right?
Probably not. Eventually, I'd love it to be in terms of like at least the major ways that people relate. But at the moment, I don't think it is.
Right. So you added the observer because you kind of noticed there was this missing pattern. So I think at the sort of the most basic level, what I see you trying to do here is catalog the different ways people relate, try to capture the major ones, the most common ones, and then be able to describe them kind of in a useful way so people can think about which of the patterns I tend to use and which do I aspire to use and which do my friends use and so on. There's an additional thing that a system like this could try to do, which is harder to do and harder to prove, which is it could try to make predictive claims, like say, well, we can assess who's a joker, let's say using a personality assessment, and then we can actually make predictions about them and say they're going to behave differently in such and such scenario, or they're more likely to have this problem or less likely to have this problem and so on. And my guess is that's where you want to get eventually, but you have to collect large data sets and do statistical analyses and so on. Is that how you're thinking about it?
Yeah, I think my main desire in terms of next steps with it is to understand what the motivations of different types are. I feel really interested just in this question of how people can relate better and how we can have more understanding with each other. And so, yes, I'm curious how people behave in different situations and how to predict their behavior. But a lot of it is like, why do they behave that way? And how can I meet more of those needs? Or how can I be aware of the reasons why they're interacting the way they are?
Right. And I think with these dialects you're talking about, you know, the internal versus external, that does get at motivation somewhat about like, why is someone doing this? Like someone could be making jokes because they're trying to entertain people, or they could be making jokes because they're trying to entertain themselves or express their own worldview or something like that. Right. And then that's like a different motivation. Is that how you think about the sort of dialects?
Yes. And the other reason that I think the dialects could be really useful in terms of like the utility of this model. Example, I have two family members who most of the time are more internally focused types. One of them is a cynic and the other one is a scientist. And they get along pretty well because they kind of know what their interaction is. They know what their boundaries are. They know how much they can push on each other. When they get stressed, one of them stays an internally focused type and the other one becomes more external. She becomes a helper. And the dynamic between them flips. And it's not just because they're using different languages. It's actually because like one of them is like trying to pull back into himself and has a lot of attention internally. And the other one has all her attention extended towards him and is really susceptible to being hurt. And you can almost think of it as like, I haven't like really wanted to correlate this with attachment styles because I feel like I need a ton more research for that. But I've been thinking of it as if you have two people that are used to being at similar levels of avoidance and all of a sudden one of them becomes anxious, it's a real shock to the dynamic. So that's actually a place I think this could be really useful, is understanding when we kind of switch types, why we run into some personality conflicts and why it's so confusing. Why is it like, I get along with this person so well most of the time, but when they're stressed, all of a sudden they're a dick to me. Part of it could be this internal-external flip.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that also speaks to why frameworks like this can be useful, which is you're noticing these patterns in how people relate. You're giving them names. And then once you give them names, they become a lot easier to both think about and talk about. So you can think to yourself like, oh yeah, I do notice that I tend to relate in this certain way to other people. And then you can also notice, oh, hey, I realize when I'm less comfortable, I'm actually relating this different way. And now you have a sort of way of kind of understanding your own behavior, but then also telling other people. You could express it to your loved ones, like, oh, you can kind of explain to them. And this is why I think this sort of the idea of love languages is so valuable. For those who don't know, the love languages is this kind of framework about how do people like to receive love? Do they want to be given gifts? Do they want to be given quality time with the other person? And once you kind of have a name for these things, now you can start having conversations with people around them and thinking about, what do I want? Why do I feel unloved by this person? What would make me feel loved? And similarly, I think with this framework, you could start thinking about, How do I relate in these different situations? How do I desire to relate? How do other people relate in a way that is not working for me? So it's kind of a useful communication tool.
Yeah. And I very obviously kind of based the name of languages worked really well for the purposes I was going for. But also I did like definitely correlate it with love languages because I just think that model is brilliant and yeah, has a lot of the same utility. At first I was thinking of it as like, how do I change someone else's behavior so that they'll be like less of a chronicler? And then as I went into it, I was like, wait a second. I know that you can't change other people's behavior, but I could change the way that I listen to them or how I interpret them or in love languages, like how much I extend myself towards giving touch, even if it's not my primary language. Well, if I'm in partnership with the chronicler, how much I extend myself towards listening for a while and then making requests around how long I'm willing for that or what needs that person has around being heard that I might be able to meet a little more than I currently am.
Now, one thing I think you'll find when you start collecting more data on this, I know you've beta tested this, which is awesome. I also know you're bringing in a psychometrician who's going to start actually helping you design studies and collect more data on this. You might find that this way of kind of carving things up doesn't quite work. Like you might find that, oh, wait, there's not actually a natural division between conversationalist and the storyteller, which you were saying you weren't sure. And maybe, in fact, in the data, they kind of merge together. You know, so I imagine that this will shift as you collect more empirical data. And I think one thing we can consider is sort of this spectrum of evidence or spectrum of confidence. And like the way I look at this, I don't know if you agree, but like the thing that we can be most confident in your framework is that it provides a terminology to talk about how we relate to each other. And that terminology might be useful for like explaining ourselves and explaining other people. So that seems like the thing that kind of needs the lowest bar of evidence. And then kind of a little bit more evidence you'd need to say that this is actually categorizing people into a way that most people will fall in one of these buckets. Or one or two of these buckets, and that will require somewhat more evidence. And then you need even more evidence to make claims about, like, very specific claims about, well, clowns tend to behave exactly like this and have this motivation, and clowns are predictive of this other thing. And that's kind of requires kind of the most intensive research and it's kind of the hardest to conduct. Do you think that's fair?
Yes. I think predicting individual behavior in situations will take some time. And I'm hoping that a lot of this gets proved differently than I think it is right now. I mean, that would be upsetting for the work that I've done, but also I'm a really big fan of the scientific process and like figuring out what is most true about something. And I feel like right now I'm drawing from the beta testers and the people I know is only like 100, 150 people sample size. And so I'm really excited to see what happens as I try to test and expand this and also see what different, if I do have the languages right, what are different permutations that I didn't know? Like even just meeting some new friends the other day, I realized that one of my presumptions about the clown, which was that clowns, their jokes are improvisational. They're from the moment. I met someone that told a lot of dad jokes and I was like, wait a second. He has his jokes prepared in advance, but he's totally a clown. It's all about the other person's reaction. So I feel like I'm constantly getting new data on them, which is fun.
Yeah, kind of fleshing out your models.
Huh?
One more point I want to make about that is if you have a categorization system, there's some sense in which a categorization is arbitrary, right? Like, let's say you had 100 animals at a zoo. There's many ways you could divide them up, right? You could divide them by, you know, mammal versus reptile, et cetera. You could divide them by size. You could divide them by how much they cost. And all of these are sort of reasonable ways to divide up a set of animals. But for any particular goal, some of those will be more useful than others. If you're the kind of CFO of the zoo and you have to make financial decisions, maybe you want to divide them up by cost. Whereas if you're a biologist, you probably want to divide them up by, you know, mammal and reptile. It's probably a more useful division. And so there's no right way to categorize things, but there are more and less useful ways to categorize things. And so I think one way to refine this over time is to say, are you carving reality at the joints in such a way that people are finding these categorizations useful? Like they're resonating, saying, ah, yes, really, that does characterize me really well. Or, oh, you know, that's not quite hitting the mark. Maybe you want to adjust your category boundaries a bit because people are falling kind of on the edges of the boundaries too much. And they're not falling into the middle of the category.
Absolutely. And one other thing that I've just had my eye on a lot is where is this useful? Like if it's just kind of a fun mental exercise, then that's great. But the things I care about is what is actually going to decrease the degree of loneliness people feel in the world, which I think is one of our greatest sources of suffering. That's kind of my mission. And if this model works well and it helps people understand each other better and thereby develop better community and better friendships and better family relationships, awesome. If it doesn't, I need to work on something else. So that's really the question I'm working with. And it in part also has a question of what are the best ways to frame this? Like, is it about how do you change your own behavior? Is it about How do you recognize the groups of people that you get along with most? Or what are the motivations of different types and how do you relate? And that's still an open question for me.
Yeah, that's a really cool mission. I think that's really important.
If you'd like to reflect on your values and identify what sorts of things you value intrinsically, there's a useful and completely free tool for that at clearerthinking.org. There are lots of things that people value: career success, friendship, family, having fun. But intrinsic values are special because they are our most fundamental values. We value them for their own sake, and we would continue to value them even if they caused no other effects. Now, like most people, you're probably not aware of all of your different intrinsic values, even though they may be influencing your behavior and goals in numerous ways. So, at Clearer Thinking, they've made a test to help you identify your intrinsic values. Taking the test will help you to figure out your most important intrinsic values, discover what your unique intrinsic values say about you, and understand why intrinsic values are so important. You can find the intrinsic values test, as well as many other tools and mini courses, on clearerthinking.org.
So you said that you often play the clown. What are your other types that you can fall into?
Well, what's really interesting about this is, like, I spent so many years leading authentic relating community that I developed this really strong questioner type. So when I started building relating languages, I was like, I'm a questioner, but I mostly only do that within that community. So I think, like, within authentic relating community, like, I've learned a chameleon to questioning type. When I feel most safe, I'm at the clown. When I feel really unsafe, I tend to be, like, at most unsafe, I'm kind of like an observing guardian, because I really didn't learn a lot of social norms when I grew up. I think I was probably somewhere along the spectrum and just really didn't understand the ways people interacted and very much lived in books. So I would have this constant reaction anytime I was in social situations where I would just freeze and not be able to interact. And actually I'd like distance from the whole group. And I do that much less these days. Like, I think I've grown, but still when I'm like in really uncomfortable situations, I'll orient towards that.
Well, that's a remarkable shift going from someone on the autistic spectrum to where you are now, where you're like basically an expert in how people relate to each other.
That's what was so cool is, like, when I stumbled across communication methodologies and I was like, oh my God, you mean somebody actually studied this? Like, I can learn ways to interact. This is crazy. Like, why did nobody teach me this in school? It's like, it went from being very consciously incompetent for a very, very long time to, like, now I've developed a little bit of a schema for how people work, and it's become less mental. But I think probably where other people develop that as somewhat of an emotional intuitive sense, it very much had to go through mental learning for me before I understood a lot of the rules of human interaction, which the benefit of that is, like, I think it's easier for me to create models like this because it's the way that my mind naturally is working on social situations.
Yeah, I've heard this from many people who struggled with social interaction when they're young. Some of them just kind of never learn it, but those that do learn it, they often learn it by first learning kind of system two cognitive reflective rules about how to do social interaction, but then they still suck at social interaction until they can practice those and practice those and practice those to get them down into system one so that they can do them real time very naturally. And that's when they become really good at socializing and sometimes even better at socializing because, like you said, they now not only have the intuition of how to do it because they practiced, but they also have a cognitive understanding that very few other people do that actually gives them advantages because they can kind of reason about the right way to do it in different situations that where intuition might go haywire.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's just such a fun thing, especially because as we're understanding more and more about the emotional body and starting to bring that into communication, like, that was honestly the reason I got into AR in the first place, was being like, wait a second, there's this entire like field of understanding that has to do with emotions and intuition and embodiment that even beyond communication, I just didn't know existed. And like, I could study that my entire life, and it requires me to develop a really different part of my mind and consciousness that I just found it really fascinating. And so as we bring those together more, I think there's a lot more richness.
So AR, that's authentic relating, right?
Yeah.
What is emotional body? I'm not familiar with that phrase.
I think I just made it up right now, but the way, the way it was existing in me is, like, I don't think the mind and body are separate, and there's neurons in my stomach and in my heart as well as in my brain. And so, like, I think of my emotions as kind of a body within my body in a way, like they are having their own reactions, which are sources of information to how I process. So I have like a mind body and an emotion body and a somatic body, and all of them are kind of collaborating to make the system of self that I'm trying to interpret. And the language that my emotional body speaks is so different from the language my mind speaks that there's very little translation between them. So a lot of my interest in the last couple of years has been, how do I listen in a way that's actually going to get that information across?
Could you share some insights you've had about that? Because that's just a really important topic.
Yeah, very much still in development. The place that I've needed it most is both in boundaries and in leading a company. So I've like led my company for the last 8 years, at the first very badly, and now maybe slightly less badly, I hope. But in terms of boundaries, I would just kind of constantly end up in situations that I didn't want to be in or didn't feel safe being in, or had to go back later and say like, hey, I know I said yes to that social engagement, but I actually don't want to go. Or sometimes even, hey, I know I said yes to that like important business arrangement, but actually I don't feel good about it. Or more often I would just stuff that and then I'd end up in bad situations. And so I really started trying to listen, and like, I was trying to like get sooner and sooner, like, was there a sensation or an emotion that would tell me that this wasn't a good choice? And I just kind of, as I refined that sense more and more and started paying attention, like in the moment, I found that I would have this, like physically, I'd feel a little bit tense and I wouldn't feel as much aliveness or energy in my body. And I would feel confused. Like I wouldn't quite have something to grab onto. Like I didn't quite know what was going on. And I contrasted it to the times when I knew that I was a yes to something, where like I would be leaning forward and I'd feel a lot of energy in my body and like solidity across my chest, and I wouldn't feel confused. So I started just, when I felt confused and uncertain, I just said no. And I started realizing, oh, I think that's a sign that I have a boundary. But because my body has never really been allowed to have boundaries, being socialized like as a woman in a fairly dysfunctional family, it just had no idea what a boundary was. So that's kind of where that attentiveness, I kind of had to like put together the puzzle piece of what was happening between the situations where I was a yes and when I was a no, when I couldn't just go, body, what's my boundary?
That's really interesting. One perspective on emotions I think can be fruitful is thinking of them as situation detectors. Like anxiety, when it's functioning properly, is like a danger situation detector, right? When it goes haywire, it's like the smoke alarm that goes off every time you cook, even though there's no fire, right? It's sort of like overly sensitive and it's kind of firing all the time. Or the reverse, it's not firing even when you're in really dangerous situations, right? And you're putting yourself in trouble. So that, you know, if anxiety is kind of like a danger situation detector, and then you can have, you know, other emotions like anger can be a someone is interfering with my goals situation detector. So I think this is a really useful frame, because when you look at it this way, instead of dismissing emotions, you think, okay, what is this emotion trying to say to me? What is it? What is it detected? And, you know, keeping in mind that the detectors are imperfect and sometimes they go haywire, but it's giving you really, really valuable information. And it really helps to learn to pick up on its signals, not ignore them, and try to like use all the useful information that it can give you, while also recognizing that sometimes it's going to go haywire and sometimes you're going to have to just override it and say, you know what, I know I feel angry at this person, but really I'm in the wrong, not them, you know, and, you know, therefore I'm going to need to find a way to get over this feeling of anger.
Totally. I'm still the biggest fan of the technique of taking a breath, or taking 10 breaths when you're upset, which, by the way, I forget all the time, but it's like the top facilitation tool that I teach any leader, is like, when the room is in chaos, when you don't know what to do, just invite everyone to take a breath.
Yeah, just calm everyone's nervous system.
Yeah, it calms everyone's nervous system, gives you space. I also teach them to reflect, because great as reflecting is when somebody is upset, it also wins you, the speaker, time to calm down, which is really kind of the greatest side effect of it.
First, inflate your life vest before inflating the ones around you, right?
Right, because if you don't, you're just stabbing someone else's life vest, as far as I can tell. I'm really struck by what you said, too, about the smoke detector. I've heard that analogy and I really like it. Because one thing that has happened for me is, because I've like struggled chronically with, I don't want to say struggled, I kind of, metaphors mean a lot, because I have worked with anxiety and depression in myself for a long time, I haven't been able to trust my body's signal as much. Like when it goes into that guardian mode, it's telling me that everything is dangerous. And so I've found somatic and emotional awareness most useful for like kind of throwing out any ideas about how I tell whether something is safe and really just kind of noticing the contrast between when I am safe, what is happening in me, and in other times, what's happening in me, and how can I start to notice the nuances of like when I'm feeling more unsafe versus less unsafe in social situations. And that was really helpful to me.
Yeah. But it seems like part of getting better at reading emotions is noticing them faster when they shift. And often that gives you a lot more information. I find that if even 10 minutes goes by before I notice my emotional shift, it can be very hard to pinpoint, well, what exactly was it that triggered it? Whereas if you get it within 30 seconds or 10 seconds even, it's usually only one thing has happened in the last 10 seconds. So it's often easy to pinpoint. So this is this technique I recommend people try to develop, what I call the inner why technique, which is just trying to learn to notice as soon as your emotion shifts and then just ask yourself why, what just happened? Why do I think that my emotion just shifted? And kind of getting better and better at that to pick up a kind of that really nuanced information. It's like, oh, it was when she used the word whatever, that's when I like suddenly felt anxious. Okay, now I can understand what happened. Whereas like 5 minutes later, you're just feeling this feeling of anxiety. You have no idea what caused it.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a bunch of games around that in authentic relating that I really love. One of which is just a somatic game called Noticing, where you go back and forth saying, being with you, I notice like somatic emotionally in my body, or I feel. And the other person says, hearing that, I notice or I feel. And you get this kind of real time awareness of how somebody's statements and how your own body are influencing the way that you feel and the way you're responding. Yeah, that one's really cool. And then my other favorite one, it's kind of like finding awareness by bouncing off of someone else, but the clown in me loves it, which is a game called Translator, which one of our facilitators based off the Obama anger translator skit by Key and Peele, like way, way long ago. But you've got two or more people having a conversation and each of them has a translator, and one person speaks and then their translator says what they think they mean. And then the other person responds and the translator translates. So like the two people who are being translated are kind of having a normal conversation, but one person might say, I'm curious what you did this weekend. And the translator might say, I'm going to ask a socially acceptable question to get you to open up because I don't want to.
I love it. That's so great. It's so funny.
It's so good because then you notice through the contrast of like, wait a second, that wasn't what I meant. Or wait a second, that was what I meant. It's really insightful to have something to bounce off of.
And you created a whole book of these games, right? Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I came into the authentic relating movement when it was really young. And I started leading a community in Austin and in Houston around it. And one of the things I noticed is that there were a couple of communities that were doing authentic relating games around the world. And we would occasionally meet at like the mothership for authentic relating and circling at that time, which was the Integral Center in Boulder, Colorado. And I would meet the other leaders of the like four or five communities that existed. And they had been developing some games of their own to supplement the like 10 that existed back then. And we had been doing the same in Austin. Like the noticing game was one of the earliest ones. And there were a couple other like curiosity games, but we would run into situations where we're like, oh, people want to learn a certain skill or they want to interact in a certain way. Can we create an interaction style for that? And I started collecting the games that I came up with and the games that other leaders had come up with into this book. And over the course of the last 8 years, it's grown from 10 games of the original manual that Brian Bayer and Decker Kunov put out to more than 250 games and variations now. And it's used, and now there are like 80 plus authentic relating and circling communities around the world. And I'm finding out about new ones every day. I just found out that someone founded one in India 2 months ago that already has like 200 members, which is awesome. So it's fun to see them sprout up, but the games manual has become the source text.
I love that manual. I think it's so cool. There's so many interesting kind of, I think of them as social experiments. Maybe you don't think of them that way.
They are.
Yeah. I love social experiments. So how do people find that manual if they want to see it?
Yeah, it's on my website, which is authrev.org. So authrev.org, like Authentic Revolution. If you scroll down that page, you'll find the manual. And if you go to that website, authrev.org/relating-languages, there's like an interest list. I'm writing a book on it right now, so I'm just getting the proposal in. And hopefully that will be a good excuse to build out the model a lot more.
I think the story of how we met is actually kind of funny because maybe I'm misremembering it, but my memory of it is I found your authentic relating manual. I was like, this is so cool. I love all these social experiments. This is amazing. And I think you found an article of mine. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I found an article where you talked about some of the best interaction styles that you'd found. And I was reading down the article and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I want to send it to everybody I know. And then I get down to like number 20 and it says circling. And then like number 30 is like authentic relating. I was like, oh my God, I have to contact this guy.
Yeah, it's so funny. So we'd both like independently read each other's things. Thought it was really cool. And I think you might have reached out to me. It was just a great connection. Yeah.
Yeah, you helped me kind of come up with the initial version of the assessment for this. And I feel like we've had a great kind of nerd connection over the last year that I've really, really appreciated.
Yeah, I think the article you're reading of mine was I tried to catalog all these different ways of bringing groups of people that don't know each other together. Yeah, it's called Better Formats for Group Interaction. You can find it on my website, spencergreenberg.com, if you're interested. But basically, I tried to find every format for group interaction that people that don't know each other and bring them all together. Although, to be fair, Sarah's manual has like another 200. So there's a lot of cool ideas. But so, you know, we've been talking about authentic relating. And I think a question that people might have is, so what is this authentic thing? Like, what is authenticity?
My answer on that, I think, has changed a lot in the last few years, as I hope it would in the course of study. And the way I see it now is really influenced by the internal family systems model, which is like my favorite psychological model. I think it's one of the most true I've found to how people work, which is that we don't just have one self. We have multiple parts of our personality. And each of those parts of our personality has different desires and needs and background almost. So I've stopped seeing authenticity as one thing. I see it as there's different kinds of authenticity and different levels from different parts of yourself. And there's two aspects that make up authenticity. One is awareness and one is action. And so awareness is how honest are you with yourself about your different motivations, especially when they conflict. Like I can really want to get my work done one day, and I can also really want to sit and read a fantasy book. And if I'm looking for what is the most authentic self, I'm just going to get real confused because they're both authentic and I can be aware of what both want. And then agency is like, am I congruent between the values I hold, the feelings I have, and the actions I do? So I can be authentic with my feelings, but that's going to be kind of confusing, right? Like, I'm going to be authentic about feeling like I want to eat cake one day, and then next day I'm going to be authentic about feeling like I should beat up on myself and feel guilty for eating cake. Like, our emotions aren't super great guides of behavior, as we were saying earlier with the kind of smoke alarm thing. They're not always accurate, but my values remain a little bit more constant. So I think authenticity can mean a lot of things, but the goal I hold with it now is, can I find alignment? Can I be aware of the things that are true in me? And can I be aligned between what I really care about and want to grow into and what my actions are?
Hmm. So to summarize, it would be fair to say, in your view, authenticity is understanding what you're really like accurately, like without self-delusion or misunderstanding, and then acting in accordance with the values you hold, even when they come into conflict, trying to kind of resolve those conflicts.
Yeah. And then, of course, communicating that to other people as accurately as possible.
Your outside kind of matches your inside in so much as possible.
Exactly. And a lot of the time when we say that someone is inauthentic, I think what we're actually saying is that what we're feeling from them is different from what they're saying. And that can either happen because they're not aware of what's happening in them, and so they can't have congruence, or they are aware, but there are different parts of them operating, and one part is like ashamed of what's true for them, and another part has a different need, and they're not able to find congruence between those different parts. And they're not able to speak to the fact that all of those things are happening. Because authenticity is not always, we don't always get to say the pleasant thing. I'm like, what am I going to say right now about authenticity that I don't think is acceptable? Like, there are views that I have around like cancel culture right now and around the way that race and gender dialogues are being handled, that even if I think they are valid opinions, I wouldn't feel comfortable saying them because of the degree of censure that comes now when, you know, anybody speaks in those topics. And so I might be able to say them honestly and transparently, but it's not authentic or congruent with the value that I hold around saying things that are going to be useful and contributory to the people around me and to the movement that I'm part of, rather than kind of just expressing what's on my mind. Like, if I think it's a really important view to express in service of bringing a viewpoint that I think is really being missed in a way that's harmful, then I'm going to be open and honest and transparent about that. But otherwise, I'm being authentic to the deeper value that I'm holding around when to speak and what about.
I wonder if people differ in the extent to which they view themselves as like a unified self, or maybe even deeper, the extent to which they feel like a unified self. So internal family systems, which for those, or IFS, for those who've never used it, is a kind of therapeutic system where you imagine these different parts of yourself and you have these kind of internal interactions between these parts of yourself. Like maybe you have, you know, an injured child part of yourself, and then maybe your adult self is going to have a communication with that child self, and you kind of imagine it. And when I do this, it feels to me like I'm doing an improv game. I don't really fundamentally feel like these parts are like real in some sense. I feel like they're things I imagine, they're trying to express some part of like what I think or what I feel. You know what I mean? So it's not like completely made up, but it does feel like an improv game to me. And I feel like, so my kind of steel man of what's going on is that it's just a method of self-communication that some people find useful. But there's other ways to like self-communicate. You could just sort of like write down the pros and cons about, you know, why you like and don't like something, or but this is kind of a more visceral way of doing it, where you're like imagining a child part that has certain needs and another part that has other needs. But I suspect that other people actually feel like these parts are more real. They feel like they're less of an improv game and more like something fundamental. I'm curious to hear your reaction to that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that there are different ways of using the model, and admittedly, I may just be bastardizing it based on what worked best for me. I think you could see the parts as anywhere between actual distinct selves that you give a name and an image to, and like formless motivations and backgrounds. And I think you can either like have your ego dialogue with them or have them dialogue with each other. Sometimes it can be really helpful for me to recognize where those are already in dialogue, but I think I don't often even say my inner child is in dialogue with my inner peacemaker or whatever. It's more like the part of me that really wants acknowledgement and feels like I didn't get enough of it when I was young, like I can see where that came from, is in conflict with the part of me that really wants like to be open source and give a lot to the movement that I'm part of, which developed over seeing the pain in the academic realm from not enough sharing of information and really like having a desire to be excited and play with other people. So it's like I have those two motivations in the moment, and I can look at where both of them came from and why both are valid. And when I feel that, then I just feel kind of like a sadness and a tenderness and an ability to hold more paradox that both of them can be true. And I might have to do something to meet both of their needs.
Yeah, that's how I look at it, as sort of I'm giving a kind of visual image or identity to a motivation I have or a feeling I have, but I'm really making up that image. It's just sort of like a helpful way of communicating about that. I think some people, though, take them much more seriously and they kind of view them as more real in some sense.
Totally. I'm also thinking, as you say that, that there might be something around like the degree to which people find visualizations helpful. Because like I'm a very visual person. And so I think I find tools like that useful. Like I can see them in my mind while I talk. I think people like learn and experience in all sorts of different ways. So it just might not be a useful tool for everyone. And that's really like the paradox of this whole thing, right? Like when you find a useful tool for one person, it's not the most useful tool for someone else. So it's just kind of like everybody's got their own drawing board.
Yeah. You know, when I encounter a new system, even if I'm kind of skeptical of some of the claims it makes, if lots and lots and lots of people say they got a lot of value on it, I like to come into the situation saying there's probably something valuable here. Like, we know that there are things that just don't work at all that people still claim they get value out of. So we have to have some skepticism. Like, for example, some homeopathic medicines are literally sugar pills. Like, you could analyze them from a chemical composition viewpoint, and they're literally only contain sugar. And so we can be pretty confident that that's not doing anything to people other than the placebo effect. And people still...
Myers-Briggs.
Myers-Briggs, a lot of people are critical of Myers. But anyways, so we know that there are things that like do nothing and yet people find them really valuable. So we have to have that level of skepticism. On the other hand, if you have a psychological system and lots of people say, oh, this changed my life, I like to come in saying there's probably something worthwhile here, even if it's not the whole thing, maybe it's not even half of it is useful, maybe it's just bits and pieces. What is the most useful stuff? I think that's just a valuable frame to have, that there's probably some value. Let me try to find it. What is valuable here? That's kind of how I view IFS, as like, I think it can be really useful for some people as a way of digging into their motivations, digging into their feelings in a way that they find palatable. And, you know, I definitely know a lot of people that reported feeling benefits from it. My own personal experience with it, I don't feel like I've gotten anything out of it, but that doesn't really mean very much. I'm one person, so.
Yeah, the reason I think I have liked it is because when I've used it with other people, it's often been one of the most powerful tools I've used, often even more on other people than myself, because there's something about the core principle of not having to make everything in yourself make sense for just a couple minutes, where it's like, okay, for parts to be incongruent, that seems like one of the most useful parts of the model. Like, take everything else away, but just don't expect that you're going to make total sense and allow space for that. But with all of these, I feel like I just constantly try to get my mind out of the belief that I'm going to find a tool that works for everyone. Like, even as a teacher, my trainings often go through 20 or 30 iterations to get to the point where I feel like they're good enough, where like everyone's going to get something out of them. But there's going to be a real difference between the people that get a super profound realization because it was the right learning style and they came in the right mindset and we communicated it right, even like that's not a great word to use. We communicated it in a way that worked with them versus the people that just like came in a different state, or it wasn't the right form of learning, or they had a bad experience with a leader in the training. So it really feels like this constant like acceptance of ambiguity and straining towards doing as well as possible, and also straining towards just like apologizing when I don't.
Well, I do appreciate the mindset of iteration that you have, where you're clearly trying to make your content better all the time, iterate and learn from the data. And it's not always, you know, it's not like you're doing randomized control trials, but you're reacting to what works and what's happening. And there are failure modes there. You know, sometimes people spiral off into, they keep convincing themselves what they're doing was working. But as any startup founder knows, user feedback and iteration can really go wonderful places and can make a product better and better and better.
One of the most interesting things to me about human behavior and my own that I've been thinking about lately is why we have that mode of going towards the status quo or the simplest explanations. Like, we know that things are going to change all the time. We know that like as soon as a good iteration of something is reached, there's already a better one out there. It's like what Heraclitus said, like by the time you step into the river a second time, both you and the river have moved on. Like, you can never step into the same river twice. But our minds want this sense of stability and security that's just out of alignment with the way the world works. And that's so fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's like when we have something good, we just want to hold on to it. We don't want to accept the fact that it's every day it's going to be a little different and one day it's going to be gone.
Right. And somehow we're optimized for stability instead of change, despite the fact that change is much more stable than stability.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because there's this dichotomy I've noticed. It's really a spectrum between people where some people really focus on stability. Other people really focus on what I call acceleration, where like stability is like, okay, you've got good things, try to hang on to them, try to reduce risk, reduce variance. And then acceleration is like, I want to maximize my potential. I want to maximize myself. I want to, you know, self-improve, et cetera. And I definitely see a split to some degree based on sort of people's history, where, for example, people who grew up in really difficult situations, whether poverty or in a country with war or things like that, I think they tend to have a very strong stability focus, which makes perfect sense because it's like they didn't have stability, right? That stability is what they wanted. And if they can get it now, it feels like incredibly desirable. Whereas people who grew up with like tons of stability, they don't necessarily value it very much. They just view it as sort of the default, the baseline. And they want to say, well, how do I self-actualize? How do I find the love of my life? How do I become the best version of myself and so on? And they tend to be very acceleration focused.
That definitely feels true. Like the degrees of potential people have for that. I had a fascinating experience once in a training that I was leading where I kept feeling like something was off in it. People kept being frustrated and I couldn't really tell what was going on. Like, I had tried slowing things down. I had tried speeding things up, like more ambiguity, less ambiguity. And eventually the class basically revolted, which was pretty funny, honestly. It was a leadership training. I offered it at an activity where someone could stand up and advocate for something they wanted. And the first student who stood up convinced the entire class to walk out of the room and go play for 20 minutes.
Wow.
Okay, something's going on here. So I got everyone back in the room and I was like, I have an intuition of what's going on. We're going to do a spectrum, which is where you offer two opposites and people stand on either side of the room on a spectrum between them. Or online, you can have just a little thing that you put icons on, share a Google slide or something, or a mirror board. And I said, on this side of the room, on the left side, I want people who feel like life kind of is never quite fast enough for you. Like you always want things to move quicker. You want intensity from it. You want excitement. And you feel like this training is just going too slow. And on the right side of the room, I want people who tend to feel like life is moving too quickly. Like you want things to slow down. You don't feel like you have quite enough time to process. And even this training maybe is feeling a little bit too fast. And I had people pressed against the wall on either side. And all of a sudden it became really clear what was happening in the training, because it was like authenticity. Like everybody had this idea that the leadership was doing something wrong because they didn't feel like their needs were being met. But what was actually happening was that the needs were so diverse that there was no way of meeting both of them at the same time. And what we actually had to do after that was offer different options for the different groups. So like, if you want to go faster, here's the experiential sped up version. If you want to go slower, stay in the room. We're going to discuss the theory a little bit more, and then you can do something experiential.
Nice.
Could the act of answering open-ended questions about yourself give you new, important insights? It turns out the answer is yes, if those questions are selected in just the right way. After running a series of 5 scientific studies, Clearer Thinking has discovered a specific set of practical, yet rarely asked questions that 83% of people reported were valuable for them to answer, and 78% said they would recommend to others. A remarkably high 88% of people even reported that they enjoyed answering these questions, and Clearer Thinking is now making those questions available to you for free on clearerthinking.org so that you can benefit from them as well. You can also order a beautiful physical card deck of the life-changing questions so that you can use the questions to bond with friends and family. We think you'll be surprised just how valuable answering these open-ended questions about yourself can be. To answer the free life-changing questions or to find Clearer Thinking's other free tools and mini courses, head to clearerthinking.org.
I have a lingering curiosity, which is just like in the relating languages, where you would put yourself.
Great question. Yeah. So I was thinking about that when you were going through the languages. Definitely under the questioning relating language, I can be a scientist. I'm often curious about people, like I want to understand them. So for example, let's say I meet someone who's really into fashion. Personally, I don't really care about fashion. It's just not an interest of mine. But I could question them for half an hour about the details of like, okay, and how do you decide what color to make your, you know, dresses this season, and, you know, anything that kind of connects to human psychology and why humans decide the way they do, you know, I'll kind of be endlessly curious. So I think I'll often question people kind of out of that motivation of trying to understand either the person themselves or some aspect of what they do. Another one that I definitely relate to is the maker one, whereas, you know, there's a lot of things I'm trying to make in the world. And if someone is like, oh, I've been thinking about self-control lately, I wonder how that works. Like, you know, I'll immediately, you know, be able to dig in really deep with them. So if they kind of hit on one of these topics I've been thinking a lot about lately, like, you know, like I want to kind of like explore with them, maybe even try to discover new things in our conversation together that we didn't know before.
That totally makes sense. I kind of had imagined those might be the two that you would speak to.
Oh, really? I should have made you guess first.
Well, it's actually funny, like, when I was talking about them, I was like, I think Spencer might be scientist. And then when you were talking about the scientist, I was like, I bet he has some maker too. I feel weird categorizing people, but it also explains, like, I think I also have a lot of like the doer, like some of the maker and some of the helper. And I think it's one reason why we get along, because I find it just like endlessly fascinating to talk about this stuff. And then also talk about, well, like, what can we make with that? And what creations does it lead to? Like, there's a bit of practicality there that I find really fun.
Mm-hmm. I remember one time many years ago when I went on a blind date and I wasn't really feeling it. I wasn't really interested in the person. So I just kind of went into scientist mode and I just asked this person questions for like, you know, the entirety of the whole date. And I remember afterwards, the person was like, oh, that was really great, but I don't know anything about you. And I was like, yep, you know, literally nothing, you know, literally nothing about me. Yeah.
That's so funny. My mom is very much a scientist and she does this thing where like when she meets people, she'll like pepper them with questions the entire time. And so like, they just start answering because like there's no space in the conversation. And then once the conversation is over, they'll go away and she'll turn to me and she'll just be like, that person was so rude. They weren't curious at all. I was like, you literally didn't leave them any space to talk.
That's funny. Yeah. That's an interesting element of like, okay, if you're going to be, you know, a scientist, you better expect people to answer your questions and not be asking them all the time because you're not going to give them space for that and so on.
Yeah, which is a great kind of pointing to the learning that's possible in each of them. Because it's like, if you recognize that that's something you do, like, I had to learn to artificially leave a lot of spaces in my conversation. And it feels like stretching a weird new muscle. But then sometimes, like, I mean, being a scientist can be really fascinating. Like, there's not always a reason to change it because people like being asked questions.
Yeah, I think most people do really like it when you have genuine curiosity about them and they enjoy talking about themselves. So it kind of works out. Another mode I can definitely fall into is a teacher. And this one I have to be careful a bit because let's say someone's like in an offhanded way is like, I wonder how such and such works. I could easily jump into like a 20-minute, you know, impromptu presentation about how that thing works. And I have to catch myself and be like, okay, do they actually care that much? Or did they just want like the 30-second version? So that's sort of something I need to watch out for, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's really hard. I mean, I think that's almost a corollary to the scientist is when you're fascinated about things and you gain a lot of information and you expect that everyone else is as fascinated by the world as you are, it can be really easy to just like get into it and lose people. I love hanging around teachers and makers because I feel like I learn so much more about the world and about topics than I otherwise would. Because if you really specialize in it, it's just like a really fascinating learning space.
You know, one reason among many that I think Myers-Briggs is so popular is because it sort of tells everyone that they're good, right? Like there's no like bad Myers-Briggs type. And I think that that's actually a nice aspect of your framework too. It's like, none of these are bad to be, you know what I mean? None of them are sort of things that you would be embarrassed about. And I think that's helpful because it makes people more open to kind of accepting the language and kind of also being willing to really think about, well, what am I really?
Yeah, I think it actually is one of the biggest kind of issues that I see with the framework right now is that there are a couple types, like the chronicler and the teacher, which are like socially not seen as good things. But like what we're saying about authenticity, it's like, I think that everything that we do and say like comes from a motivation that is fundamentally meant usually both in service of ourselves and in service of other people. So I think that just means that like, I don't understand yet what a lot of the benefits of the chronicler and the teacher are. Like, it's actually easier to see with the teacher that like, I know teachers that are just some of like the best people in the world to receive information from and so fascinating and have delved so deep into their topics. And I also know chroniclers who are really, really good for actually understanding what happened in a situation.
Right. Well, also the chronicle type, which is just to remind people, I believe that was the one where people will just kind of start telling you a story, you know, whether you kind of are engaged or not. I feel like that works well with people who are super close. Like, you know, you talk to your best friend or you talk to your partner and you just kind of like tell them about your day. And you know what I mean? Like, it's a very familiar style that like makes sense in a certain context.
Well, that's a thing also, like speaking about, there's a real difference I've found between short-term and long-term relationship. So for instance, like being a teacher might work really well for people that you've just met. But if you've been in a relationship for a while, it's possible that somebody will be like, hey, you're teaching me about that thing again. I want to know more about who you are. Or the same thing you said for being a scientist, like people love being asked questions. But if you're just doing questions over a longer term relationship, they want to understand more about, well, tell me about you. And I think it's the same like chroniclers in long term relationship that can be really great. And with other types, like with an observer, a chronicler can often be a wonderful thing because they'll start the conversation and they'll keep it going and they offer enough fodder for things to actually go somewhere. Or with a bard, like they allow kind of a way in and they're not worried about starting the conversation and keeping it going. Whereas an observing type can sometimes be awkward to be around.
That's an interesting way to think about it. You know, you mentioned Myers-Briggs. I feel like we should just talk about that briefly. It sounds like you're not too big a fan of it.
Yeah, only because, I mean, I'm honestly, I think that Myers-Briggs is fine. I think that it's a really useful framework. And for a lot of the reasons you talk about, like if we have understanding of who we are or a certain model of who we are, it gives us something to bounce off of, which I think is immensely helpful. I was just digging on it because like the actual studies of the validity of the different types and the tests for it have been largely disproven, but I still think it's really useful.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a really interesting to think about because there are lots of people that love Myers-Briggs. It's probably the most popular personality test in the world, used by all kinds of people for all kinds of things. And one question we could ask is like, how valid is it? Another question we could ask is like, why is it so popular? Then you have sort of the question of like, what is it useful for? Right. And so, you know, all this, you know, bring back this kind of spectrum of evidence I talked about briefly before, like all the way at one end of the spectrum, you could just say, well, it's just a language. It's just a way of describing things. And there, it can't really be wrong. It could be more useful or less useful, but you know, it seems like a lot of people find the language useful to talk about themselves, to talk about other people, what sort of people they tend to like, what sort of people they tend to hang out with. And that's just sort of a way of describing things. All the way at the other end of the spectrum, you can make very specific claims about, oh, these types of people will these two types were more likely to have successful relationships with each other, whereas, you know, this type shouldn't date that type, and these types make good teams together, and so on. And I think a lot of those claims are basically BS, or, you know, if they're true, then they're only slightly true. And so, you know, so I think it's like sort of depends on what kind of claims we want to make about it. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people try to use Myers-Briggs for things it's not really valid for, and they don't just think of it as sort of a useful framework for, you know, discussing what you're like and trying to understand other people.
Yeah, I feel like when we have a new tool in our toolbox, we want to use it on everything. And it takes a while to know like where it is and isn't a good hammer for the nail and what is and isn't a nail. I think a lot of that is kind of learning process. And if in the process, you know, you discover something about yourself or about a relationship with someone else that you didn't know before, just because you had no framework to attach it to, then like, awesome. But I like what you said earlier about going into anything that everybody is like, this is amazing, with like, okay, I can probably learn something here. What is the thing that I can learn? And then like, what other models do I need? And what kind of scientific questioning do I need to do to make sure that I'm not taking this on as the one and only truth? Because that can really be blinding to any other possibilities.
Right. There's sort of this validity frame, which is useful to have, where you come in skeptical and say, like, does this thing really do what it claims? And I think Myers-Briggs has a very spotty record with that. And then there's another frame, which is just, what can I learn here? Why do so many people find this valuable? And there's something to learn from that. And you might be able to pull out some pieces that are useful. On the specific claims about Myers-Briggs, you know, the sort of validity stuff it struggled on. One, it wants to cut people into these dichotomies, like you're an E or an I. And there's just a fundamental problem with cutting people into dichotomies, which is that a lot of people lie near the middle, because these things tend to have sort of bell curve type shapes. So if most people lie near the middle, and then you want to cut it and say some are either some are I, you're going to get a lot of people right near that boundary. And it tends to create a lot of flipping. So if you look at Myers-Briggs types, they tend to change a lot throughout time. Like if you take the test a month later, you might actually get a different type, because maybe you were just near the middle and then you add some random noise and you're flipping between these different dichotomies. So I think that's one of the big struggles. Another struggle is that it kind of came up the theory very early on, and then much, much later tried to like make the test really valid, but they're kind of still stuck in the parts of the theory that were just came out of, you know, just thinking, but didn't have much data behind them at the time. So I think they're sort of saddled with this sort of theory that isn't quite right. It doesn't quite work.
I appreciate that. It feels like a much more nuanced view on it. And I'm just thinking about like something I'm struggling with in developing my own model is the fact that like, if I really stick with the degree of nuance that I think is true for it, like people lie on a spectrum between two dialects and people can change at different times and people, you know, the things that feel most accurate to it, it makes it hard to explain. Like people like simple models, and I know that it would have a lot more adoption if I just simplified it a bunch. And there is this kind of constant question of like, how much am I going to go with scientific accuracy versus how much am I going to really like try to get people interested enough that they'll delve deeper? And I think one of my paragons for what that looks like in a good way actually is the Enneagram, because whether or not it's very scientifically accurate, they have, I think, done a really good job of presenting a basic framework at the outset that has a lot of nuance once you dive deeper into it.
Right. You can start with something simple and then kind of unpack it and unpack it and unpack it for those that are interesting. I think the Enneagram is like very unscientific. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it can be useful language, you know, and I think that's why I draw this distinction between are we just coining types that we can then use as a way of talking about people? Like that person's kind of like a seven. You know, and then, okay, I can communicate a lot. Once we have that language, I can communicate a lot of information. Or are we making an empirical claim that sevens are almost always like this, and they almost always, you know, are better off doing that? And that, I think, is a lot of bullshit personally. But yeah, you know, on the Myers-Briggs in particular, I just want to say the last couple things about it. They have these kind of four dichotomies. But if you view them as spectrums instead of dichotomies, like instead of thinking ear and eye, you think introvert to extrovert, right? It sort of has an interesting relationship to the Big Five test, the Big Five personality test, which is the EI spectrum is almost perfectly maps onto the Big Five's introversion, extroversion spectrum. Then there's the judger's perceiver spectrum in Myers-Briggs, which maps onto conscientiousness. I think of it as sort of a more specific form of conscientiousness. So Big Five has kind of this broader construct, and whereas the judger to perceiver spectrum is kind of more narrow. But basically, I think one way to look at Myers-Briggs is it's actually a lot like a four-factor instead of five-factor Big Five personality test that sort of is measuring sort of more narrow traits rather than these broader traits. So I kind of view it as like a not as accurate Big Five test. And the trait that's missing is neuroticism. Like there's nothing. So in the Big Five test, there's neuroticism, which is about tending to be anxious and depressed and emotionally reactive and getting angry easily and stuff like that. And that's just totally missing from the Myers-Briggs.
I love this. I feel like I'm learning so much more about both Myers-Briggs and like accurate methodology of testing right now. And it's also making me realize that like there's such a difference between what I think I've learned is external and internal validity. Like, does something make sense on the surface and is it useful to use as a framework versus like, does it actually correlate with what you're talking about? And, you know, is it Misi? And from what you're saying, it's like, oh yeah, like there are a lot of useful things about Myers-Briggs, even though it might not be testing exactly what it says it is. And of course, like I have a connection to Enneagram just because I've used it more, but that doesn't mean that it's any more scientific than Myers-Briggs is. And so there's also a way that like, I guess I'm learning right now, being reminded again to not look down on things until I've really considered where they are accurate and why and what they're useful for, instead of like dismissing them on like, well, this is unscientific. Well, what does unscientific mean?
Right. Well, you know, if we think, you know, at being as charitable as possible, just coining a word can be really useful. Like, you know, the word ennui, the existence of the word is not making kind of a scientific claim, but it's a useful word because you might notice in the world a time when it fits really well. And you're like, I'm experiencing ennui. And then suddenly you can communicate a lot to someone really. And I think of it as, you know, if you know the Enneagram really well, someone can communicate a lot of information being like, oh, that person's really a four. You know what I mean? Like, that's a ton of information. Now, it's not going to be perfectly accurate because nobody's a perfect four, you know, but insofar as that person's, that's a pretty good model for that person. Now, there might be other people that fit the model terribly where, you know, if you actually try to put them in the Enneagram types, they're just not going to work really well, or they're really going to be four of the types mixed together. And there, you're going to really struggle to use that framework to communicate much of anything for that person. And so my problem with the Enneagram is not that, I think as a language, it can be nice. My problem with it is I don't think it's very scientific, in the sense that I think if you were to actually try to make a really good assessment system and slot people into the types, what you find is that while the Enneagram system claims that people tend to fall very strongly into one type, that's not really true. In fact, a lot of people would bleed across like two or three types, and it just wouldn't be nearly as clean as they want to say. And some people wouldn't be well represented at all.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of a constant question for me, is like, how accurate does it need to be useful? And what sorts of disclaimers do you have to give about where it is and isn't useful? And like at a wider level, like what is the system even trying to do? And is it useful for that? Like if it is to describe the behavior of everybody and how they interact, then it's not useful. But like you said, if it's to be able to have a shorthand for talking about somebody, like, oh, that person is kind of like a four, that might be really valid, because we process so much information all the time that we need those kind of heuristics to even make sense of things. I love, by the way, thinking of language. Have you ever read The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows?
No, it sounds great though.
It's one of my favorite things on the internet. It's a guy who looked at all sorts of emotions and situations that are commonly experienced for which there is no word, and just started making up words for them.
Oh, that's awesome.
So one of the best ones is Sonder, which is a word he made up to describe the sudden realization that everyone is living a life as varied and complex as your own.
That's a wonderful word. I love it.
All of these. And it's so cool because, you know, the English language doesn't include a lot of them. And so there's a lot of things that we just can't talk about. And that's why I think systems that are even partial can be useful, because even if they're not correct, they give us a way to start a conversation.
Right, exactly. In the best case scenario, with a system like Enneagram, they would have proven that sevens behave in a certain way, and seven, you can predict what sevens will do in different situations, and you can predict that sevens will get along with threes. And I don't think they've done that work, but they provide a language that many people find useful. And, you know, and hoping with your test, you know, I really like the framework you're developing. I think it has a lot of potential. And, you know, I hope that you'll, as you do more and more of the empirical stuff, you will find some really cool relationships where you can actually make valid claims about, you know, oh, if you're a doer, maybe you're more likely to do this. So you're more likely to have this motivation, more likely to get along with that kind of person, and et cetera. I think that would be a really awesome way to develop your work.
Yeah, I would be so excited if that were possible. And like, if somebody who is in relationship, I had somebody who, the first version of the manual that I wrote that I gave to the beta testers included a lot of suggestions for like how to relate to different types if you're wanting to either join them in their conversation or ask them to relate in a different way. One of kind of the heartening stories that I got was one of the things I said about maker, I think it was about makers, is that they have a hard time slowing down. Or doers in general, they have a hard time slowing down. And sometimes one of the best things you can do is actually like give them a drink or a cigarette or something. I was kind of basing this off my partner's community, which has those norms. so that they actually have like something in their hands and a means to relax. And one of the beta testers wrote back and was like, that sentence was one of the most useful ones that I ever read. It finally allowed me to understand some of my dad's alcoholism. So I don't think that's like true across the board, but I'm finding that some of kind of the descriptions of actions that people do and why they do them have been really useful. Like, that's kind of my hope, is like, where can this help people destigmatize the beliefs that they've had about those around them? Where, and especially like kind of that core question of where can we stop judging our parents for doing small talk or not being interested in us, or our uncle that cracks mean jokes all the time, but instead go, okay, what is it that they're actually trying to say and that they need? And how can I meet them more in that, in such a way where I can actually change my family system by being more flexible to people's different needs?
That's really cool. Sarah, thanks so much for coming on. This was really fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks again for listening. If you have questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at clearerthinkingpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave us a voicemail at 321-341-4669. To find out more about Spencer, visit spencergreenberg.com. To find out more about Sarah, take a look at her bio in the show notes. And to find out more about our show, visit clearerthinkingpodcast.com. If you like the show, we hope you'll rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and we hope you'll tell your friends about us on social media. We also hope you'll subscribe to our email newsletter called One Helpful Idea. Each week, we'll send you one idea that we think is really valuable that you can read about in just 30 seconds, along with that week's new podcast episodes and an essay by Spencer. You can sign up for that newsletter on our website, clearerthinkingpodcast.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.